Content note. Today's episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains references to death and gruesome death and very much death and the exchange of monetary items or the remuneration of physical affection, as well as a little bit of just generally misogyny and potential abuse situation. It's just, there's some nastiness. There's some nastiness afoot.
Hey, folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us as we continue Catch-22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 33, Natalie's. I started recording the podcast just as Rue was taking a sip of water.
Yes.
I did not do it on purpose, I swear.
It's funny, but yeah, it happened. Yes. So today, how is Dave?
Been better, been worse. Doing the best I can, as all of us kind of are.
Yeah. With the world's circumstances and local circumstances and all circumstances, it's all very in flux. Yes, we've also had some very inclement weather in the last 48 hours or so, with a fair few. I mean, we get our, this is storm season for us, so this is the season where it's a bit unpredictable. We can have pretty rough electrical storms with massive hailstones in some locations. I saw one that was the size of like a grown man's fist. That was about an hour north from us. So it gets a bit rough this time of year.
We also have a giant lightning rod in the middle of surfers known as the Q1 building.
Although it has reduced lightning strikes in other places on the Gold Coast. Well, I know because
the purpose of a lightning rod.
Yes, yes. I actually look at the lightning strike apps that they use using satellite feedback and some other sensor thingies. I am obviously not a meteorologist. Anyway, but I was looking at, because we had a really loud bang very, very close. And I was like, that was a bit closer than what we're used to. And yes, it was indeed. It was just like, we're near a canal. So they were, it was on the next canal next to us. And it hit the water end of the canal, or maybe a boat or something. Like it hit somewhere where they would be towards the end of it. Yeah. It was very, very loud. And we, yes, it's usually the time of the year where at night or in the afternoon, I will start unplugging my computers or anything that is potentially sensitive. Some things you can't unplug, but at least the things that I can.
I don't know how close it was. It probably wasn't as close because I'm still here. But yeah, the thunderstorm we had a couple weeks ago, trying to get to bed and the lightning starts and then one hits relatively close because the windows start to rumble.
To shake, yeah.
It's like, oh dear. Yeah, well, I'm not getting to sleep anytime soon.
No. It gets a bit rough. So that we're at the point where we were lucky yesterday. There was a severe storm warning and it fizzled, but we had the drizzly, painful rain. There's a low pressure system, which throws everything off. It's actually a reason why we had to delay our recording by a day because I have a migraine. I don't sound it, but I have a migraine and it built up. Yesterday it was peaking with some of the less pleasant. I mean, no symptoms of a migraine are pleasant, but the least favorite symptoms of a migraine, I guess, the least pleasant hit me yesterday. And today it's just a bit of photophobia. So bright lights suck, but everything else is decent.
You're not wearing shades.
I don't have shades that are prescription.
Years ago, I got prescription sunglasses, which are a really good idea for me because I have astigmatism. So light sources are, I'm much more sensitive to bright light. But no, I just either kept forgetting them or they never felt comfortable to put on. I just never have clicked with wearing sunglasses, which I know I should for good eye health because the sun here is very powerful. But yeah, it's just never been a thing. I got to wearing hats because I was growing that bald spot and I became very insecure about it. But, you know, hats are good as well because that prevents sun damage. But yeah, sunglasses are something I've just never... I wear sunscreen, I wear a hat. I can't do the sunnies for some reason.
Yeah, I'm looking at getting some prescription sunglasses only because it's become a little ridiculous in terms of... just I think as I get older, I'm becoming more photophobic or more light sensitive. And that is it is related, again, as you've been... Astigmatism will do that. So you just... I agree. They are less comfortable than normal prescription glasses. And I'm wondering if it's because the lenses... So, random facts. Glasses, when you get normal glasses, prescription lenses, they usually put a coat on it so that it doesn't reflect from the inside. So that the light that's hitting the inside of the glass doesn't bounce back. So you don't end up looking at a reflection of your eyeball the like entire time. Mm. That would be very awkward and disconcerting. But sunglasses, they tend to not be as thin and they also tend to not have that particular coat because they have to make the sunglasses coating, right? Mm. So it does protect against, so less light comes through, but the little that does come through can tend to reflect a little bit more.
Mm. I think it's also just a comfort thing. Like maybe you're the same, but because I wear my glasses basically to operate, I never take them off except to like shower and sleep.
Yeah. You know, yeah, so and then putting them on and off and on and off. It's an extra step.
Absolutely. They're a fixture.
Yeah. Yeah. It becomes an extra step because that I think probably as we become older, we'll end up having to have reading glasses on top of our normal glasses. It'll become easier because you'll just have this extra pair of sunglasses just hanging off your neck. You know, when we're old man Dave and old Rue, we will just, you know.
Oh, that kind of happened to me. I'm reading a book I had to order online in physical form because there was no ebook version of it. It's an older, probably out of print. But this happened when I bought the new journalism for the same reason early this year because there was no ebook version. Both books, the text is tiny.
Oh, no.
And maybe it isn't, but maybe I'm just used to the fact that my Kindle, I have it like, I think, 3/4 size out of all the options. And no, it's like a really good size. And because, you know, Kindle doesn't matter the book. It's uniform. No matter what book I read on that thing, it's going to be the same text size. You get used to that text size.
Yeah. I'm looking at those... I don't know if, okay, I'm wondering if you are familiar. Have you seen any of those videos of people doing cross-stitch and they're wearing those magnifying light lit up glasses?
Oh, I have seen those glasses, not for cross-stitch, but I have seen people wear them.
Yeah, the goggles that you flip, that you're wearing basically over your head and then you flip them over so you can see bigger.
Oh, those. Great. When I was volunteering at the op shop, one of the ladies who worked there who evaluated the jewelry in that, she had like the magnify ones.
Yes, that's the one I'm looking at. I've actually been exploring them because when I was doing a lot more cross stitch last year, I reduced it because my eyes were playing up and the saga of not having the correct script definitely contributed to that. But I am looking at those quite seriously because there's less strain on your eye.
Yeah.
And when it comes to like reading, I'm like, oh, maybe. small.
I'm very familiar with eye strain because the main reason I wear my glasses is because my left eye is very lazy. Mm. So that was, I think it was around when I started uni, I went to the optometrist for the first time in a long time, got them tested because apparently, you know, I was just wearing a script for astigmatism when I was a kid. But, you know, the idea that the left eye is very lazy, therefore the right and the eye and the brain has to overcompensate.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe that's why you have trouble concentrating, or at least one of the reasons that leads to that.
It's not going
to
help. It's not going to help. No. I think, yes. So quick and easy announcement for anyone in the land of Australia. if you should be getting an eye check at least every 2 years, and Medicare will cover it. So get your eye check. In terms of the glasses, okay, that could get a bit more dear.
Yeah, that's
there are ways around it. There are different programs and things. You get this payment plans, of course, and other things. But even getting your eyeballs, and I say eyeballs because it's not just your vision that is getting checked. They are also checking the health of your eyeball. To get that checked every 2 years is on average, unless you have a script, in which case usually they say then every year, but 2 years at least. For any human being who is in Australia, generally, that is older than a child. Like, as soon as you're 18 and up and you're on your own, you're doing this stuff, go every 2 years at least, please. Thank you.
I had a public friend health years ago who got glasses, and she'd spent most of her life not with them. And she, like, the first day she wore them, she's like, the world is clearer. What?
Yeah. There is a school of thought that you shouldn't make your eyes depend on glasses and stuff. And I'm like, okay, look, yes, maybe, sure. However, you still need to get your eye health checked.
And they say you shouldn't let coffee be dependent on coffee to be awake either. Bah.
Well, the difference is that the idea is that the more you depend on your glasses, the more your eyes get weaker, which is not entirely accurate. It depends on what's causing your vision problem.
Mm.
And also, you do have breaks without your glasses. And also, there's ways to – they have some exercises that can help. But there's a lot of odd odd attitudes. It's like the whole idea of, oh, you shouldn't use a wheelchair because it'll make you more dependent. And I think, well, mate, option A is I don't go anywhere. Option B, I occasionally use a wheelchair so that I can conserve my energy, so I could do things like look after myself in the house. For example, there's some very odd attitudes towards using things like mobility aids or braces or glasses, anything, that kind of thing, anything that recognizes or acknowledges that we are human beings and there are flaws to us gets hard with this whole, but then you'll get dependent or, but then you'll, that's what's actually, you know, what's actually making you worse is wearing the glasses, and you're going, okay, mate, nah. If you're wearing an incorrect script, sure, that's not going to be good for you. If you wear your reading glasses the entire time as opposed to only when you're reading, again, sure, not an appropriate use. But that's where, it's best to be consulted between you and your optometrist. And if you have family health conditions regarding eyes, especially, then you might even have to see an ophthalmologist. That's a little different. Optometrist is not usually a doctor, whereas an ophthalmologist is.
And, you know, no matter how many times I go to the optometrist, I don't think I'll ever get used to that test where they blast your eyeball with a puff of air.
No. Okay, so yeah, if you haven't ever had this test, it's the glaucoma test. They're checking the pressure of your eyeball, and I call it the puff test, and it sucks.
Yeah.
But you know what? There are worse tests. And trust me, as someone who goes to an ophthalmologist and a neuro-ophthalmologist on a relatively regular, more frequently than your average picnic bear, you know, like more more frequently than most people,
more frequently than you want to,
more frequently than any human being really wants to. I've now finally I don't have to go every year. I can go every 2 years. Woo! still too frequent, but there are tests that are worse. There are worse tests.
I imagine
they're not painful, but they're terrible.
Well, the puff test isn't painful. It's just shocking.
Yeah, it feels wrong. Your body goes, what are you, what? No. Eyelids close when air, not open.
And the anticipation, because you're basically eye open with this giant machine in front of you.
Yeah, it doesn't help. Does not help.
But let us perhaps move on from the eyeball to what happened on Catch 22. We did two chapters last time.
Yes, we did. And stuff happened.
The first was we found out how Dr. Nika's wife is faring without her husband now.
Yeah.
Now that she has all these life insurance policies and the government is providing pensions and the Rotary Club is giving her burial allowance.
Yeah, I think she – so the system basically – he's dead according to the system, and it is reiterated and – I think she's getting paid too much to even have hope that it is not the case.
Well, the vibe I got is that she believes the letter is being sent to her from her husband. But at this point, it's like, well, I tried to do the right thing. I went to the war
I don't know.
Committee, the vibe and they told me this is fake. And I do miss my husband, but I don't have to worry about looking after my children with this.
Yeah, but my vibe is actually more that she was actually genuinely upset.
Yeah.
And the money is helping take the sting out of it, but she's still trying to do the right thing. Her husband gets a letter, gets told, no, it's fake. It couldn't possibly be real. It probably doesn't help that Yessarian and all the others have been forging signatures.
So well, she did get the form letter as well.
Yeah, and then, well, the thing is, because of the culture or the climate of, no, official things are always right. We're always right. Like the dead man in the tent and the, but I'm not on the plane. Yes, but you are, according to the flight record, therefore you are dead. You know, that kind of thing is very weird. But then you've got the whole, that there is a climate of hoaxing. So there's the forgery climate of the signatures. And so that's going to be not helping the situation either. And because it's specifically Pianosa where this forgery stuff is happening.
Yeah.
So the fact that he wrote a letter and then writes a letter saying, no, just ask Colonel Cathcart, I am alive. And then gets the form letter, dear Mr. Mrs. Mr. Mr. and Mrs. Mr. that. Letter to say from Colonel Cathcart, signed off by Colonel Cathcart. So it's actually, so even if she wanted to believe it, the person that she would turn to ask whether it's true or not, just sent a letter saying, no, he's gone. So she's like, oh, well, then he must be gone.
Mm.
And then left. So I want to give her the benefit of the doubt because I think that Danica would marry someone who's not necessarily too bright.
Hmm. Well, there was also that thing where after she got the final letter, she moved to Michigan. And yeah. I wonder if that's so, whether she believes it is her husband or not, but that person will stop mailing me, so I'm going to move.
Yeah, mailing address with no forwarding address. I wonder if she's gone. Yeah. Well, she moved. She moved. She wanted to have a better life. So as to whether it's because she wants to avoid potential follow-up or who knows, that one's a big like or just happened to be where her next step.
Well, so, there's a thought in my head that I think it was Michigan, but it would be a lot cheaper to live there than New York City where she was.
Yeah, but also all the neighbors, remember all the husbands were flirting with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she might not have wanted to. And it's interesting they started flirting with her as soon as she started having money.
Yeah, that wasn't too subtle at all, the way that was placed.
No. The fact that they were hoping that she moves soon and then she gets money and then they're flirting with her is a bit odd.
And then, of course, the follow-up chapter, Yessarian has some new bunkmates.
Yes, he's reacting very normally.
Yeah, well, it'll be fine. One or two of them will get injured or die, and then they'll learn what this hellish life is like.
Yeah, and I think, but then his paranoia kicked in as well.
Well, they got rid of the dead man in his tent pretty easy.
Yeah, and that's what caused him to be really panicky and paranoid, and so he ran. But also, I think it's because they used the logs. They used the birch logs from Orr, and that really upset him.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, didn't Orr chop those birch logs for him?
Yeah. We talked last time about how he wouldn't have burned them because it's probably like a memento keeping Orr's memory alive.
That or he's just waiting. He wants to use them to keep himself warm as intended by Orr, but they were using it when he wasn't there.
That too, or waiting till Orr comes back and they can use it together.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a whole bunch of layers to it, and it's kind of tricky with Yessarian. And they kind of treat him like everyone else treats Hungry Joe.
Mm-hmm.
He's become,
he's the old kook.
Yeah, and it's interesting that how many times we've had people say, you shouldn't be here anymore.
Yep.
It's like, I know, I've tried. They won't send me back. So he's...
Yeah, what do you do in a situation like that?
Yeah, I love the fact that he's like feeling bad for them for having to deal with Captain Black for the first time.
Well, he's still got some values and empathy left. He's just, he's got to dig a little wrecked. More for it.
Yeah, he's a bit wrecked. But yeah, so now we're moving on, and now they've run to Rome.
Mm.
And it was funny because Ysarion and Sergeant Towser had been trying so hard to figure out what to do about the dead man.
Mm.
And then they just got rid of him.
And like there, I also like the idea there was that suggestion that they could move Ysarion, and Ysarion didn't want to. Well, it's not that he didn't want to give up his tent to the men, although that was part of it. But like, no, that's my tent. That's Aura's tent. He built that stove in there for me. And
yeah, I think he's being conscious. He realizes on some level that that was done with him in mind, and his friend did that for him. And he's probably also struggling because he doesn't really have... I mean, Dunbar's not well.
Mm-hmm. Chaplain's not well.
Chaplain's not well. The few people he could turn to are not doing too well.
Chief White Halfhoat's on his way out.
Yep. And there's a lot of... He's seen too many young men die.
Mm-hmm.
I want to put it that way. The people that helped him, that cared about him, have died. Mm-hmm. Mainly, or disappeared.
Yeah.
You've got Clevenger, you've got Orr, you've got Snowden, you've got Kid Samson.
Even though he was a problem, McWatt was a friend too.
Yep. Major, with whom he kind of tried, he wasn't too bad with Major, and then Major is kind of not accessible, and
yeah.
Milo turned out to be terrifying.
Mm.
It's not good. And then, what's his name? Dodd?
Dobbs,
that's it. Dobbs, he was kind of, I think, relying on his insanity.
Hmm.
Like, he was relying on Dobbs being crazier than him.
Ah, yeah.
You know?
Hungry Joe served that purpose for a while, too.
He does, and then he doesn't. He's... Because Hungry Joe's hit the point where he does... Like, he's wanting the extra missions now so that he's not crazy. Whereas Dobbs rejected his... agreeing as soon as Ysarion agreed with Dobbs, let's get rid of Cathcart, he didn't, and now there's more issues. So I'd say he probably resents Dobbs and is frustrated that he didn't pull through. But that's technically also his fault.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So well, I have a feeling this chapter is going to be more about Nate Lee.
Yeah. Also a little bit of, I think... This one will definitely contain quite a few sexual references, so might as well get that warning out of the way, most likely. As it is a chapter about Natalie's...
Chapter 33, Natalie's... He missed Nurse Dockett in Rome. There was not much else to do after Hungry Joe left on his mail run. Ysarion missed Nurse Dockett so much that he went searching hungrily through the streets for Luciana, whose laugh and invisible scar he had never forgotten, or the boozy, blowsy, bleary-eyed floozy in the overloaded white brassiere and unbuttoned orange satin blouse, whose naughty salmon-colored cameo ring Arvy had thrown away so callously through the window of her car. How he yearned for both girls. He looked for them in vain. He was so deeply in love with them, and he knew he would never see either again. Despair gnawed at him. Visions beset him. He wanted Nurse Dockett with her dress up and her slim thighs bare to the hips. He banged a thin streetwalker with a wet cough who picked him up from an alley between hotels. But that was no fun at all, and he hastened to the enlisted men's apartment for the fat, friendly maid in the lime-colored panties who was overjoyed to see him but couldn't arouse him. He went to bed there early and slept alone. He woke up disappointed and banged a sassy, short, chubby girl he found in the apartment after breakfast, but that was only a little better, and he chased her away when he'd finished and went back to sleep. He napped till lunch and then went shopping for presents for Nurse Duckett and a scarf for the maid in the lime-colored panties, who hugged him with such gargantuan gratitude that he was soon hot for Nurse Duckett and ran looking lecherously for Luciana again. Instead, he found Arfie, who had landed in Rome when Hungry Joe returned with Dunbar, Nately, and Dobbs, and who would not go along on the drunken foray that night to rescue Nately's from the middle-aged military big shots holding her captive in a hotel because she would not say uncle. "Why should I risk getting into trouble just to help her out?" Arfie demanded haughtily. "But don't tell Nately I said that. Tell him I had to keep an appointment with some very important fraternity brothers." The middle-aged big shots would not let Nately's leave until they made her say uncle. "Say uncle," they said to her. "Uncle," she said. "No, no, say uncle." "Uncle," she said. "She still doesn't understand." "You still don't understand, do you? We can't really make you say uncle unless you don't want to say uncle. Don't you see? Don't say uncle when I tell you to say uncle, okay? Say uncle." "Uncle," she said. "No, don't say uncle. Say uncle." She didn't say uncle. "That's good. That's very good. It's a start. Now say uncle." "Uncle," she said. "It's no good." "No, it's no good that way either. She just isn't impressed with us. There's just no fun making her say uncle when she doesn't care whether we make her say uncle or not." "No, she really doesn't care, does she?" "Say foot." "Foot." "You see, she doesn't care about anything we do. She doesn't care about us. We don't mean a thing to you, do we?" "Uncle," she said. She didn't care about them a bit, and it upset them terribly. They shook her roughly each time she yawned. She did not seem to care about anything, not even when they threatened to throw her out the window. They were utterly demoralized men of distinction. She was bored and indifferent and wanted very much to sleep. She had been on the job for 22 hours, and she was sorry that these men had not permitted her to leave with the other two girls with whom the orgy had begun. She wondered vaguely why they wanted her to laugh when they laughed, and why they wanted her to enjoy it when they made love to her. It was all very mysterious to her, and very uninteresting. She was not sure what they wanted from her. Each time she slumped over with her eyes closed, they shook her awake and made her say uncle again. Each time she said uncle, they were disappointed. She wondered what uncle meant. She sat on the sofa in a passive, phlegmatic stupor, her mouth open and all her clothing crumpled in a corner on the floor, and wondered how much longer they would sit around naked with her and make her say uncle in the elegant hotel suite to which Orr's old girlfriend, giggling uncontrollably at Yossarian and Dunbar's drunken antics, guided Nately and the other members of the motley rescue party. Dunbar squeezed Orr's old girlfriend's fanny gratefully and passed her back to Yossarian, who propped her against the door jamb with both hands on her hips and wormed himself against her lasciviously until Nately seized him by the arm and pulled him away from her into the blue sitting room, where Dunbar was already hurling everything in sight out the window into the court. Dobbs was smashing furniture with an ash stand. A nude, ridiculous man with a blushing appendectomy scar appeared in the doorway suddenly and bellowed, "What's going on here?" "Your toes are dirty," Dunbar said. The man covered his groin with both hands and shrank from view. Dunbar, Dobbs, and Hungry Joe just kept dumping everything they could lift out the window with great howling whoops of happy abandon. They soon finished with the clothing on the couches and the luggage on the floor, and they were ransacking a cedar closet when the door to the inner room opened again, and a man who was very distinguished-looking from the neck up padded into view imperiously on bare feet. "Here you, stop that," he barked. "Just what do you men think you're doing?" "Your toes are dirty," Dunbar said to him. The man covered his groin as the first one had done and disappeared. Nately charged after him, but was blocked by the first officer, who plodded back in holding a pillow in front of him like a bubble dancer. "Hey, you men," he roared angrily, "stop it." "Stop it," Dunbar replied. "That's what I said." "That's what I said," Dunbar said. The officer stamped his foot petulantly, turning weak with frustration. "Are you deliberately repeating everything I say? Are you deliberately repeating everything I say? I'll thrash you," the man raised a fist. "I'll thrash you," Dunbar warned him coldly. "You're a German spy, and I'm going to have you shot." "German spy? I'm an American colonel." "You don't look like an American colonel. You look like a fat man with a pillow in front of him. Where's your uniform, if you're an American colonel? You just threw it out the window." "All right, men," Dunbar said. "Lock the silly bastard up. Take the silly bastard down to the station house and throw away the key." The colonel blanched with alarm. "Hey, Are you crazy? Where's your badge? Hey, you, come back in here. But he whirled too late to stop Nately, who had glimpsed his girl sitting on the sofa in the other room and had darted through the doorway behind his back. The others poured through after him right into the midst of the other naked big shots. Hungry Joe laughed hysterically when he saw them, pointing in disbelief at one after the other and clasping his head and sides. Two with fleshy physiques advanced truculently until they spied the look of mean dislike and hostility on Dobbs and Dunbar, and noticed that Dobbs was still swinging, like a two-handed club, the wrought iron ashstand he had used to smash things in the sitting room. Nately was already at his girl's side. She stared at him without recognition for a few seconds. Then she smiled faintly and let her head sink to her shoulder with her eyes closed. Nately was in ecstasy. She had never smiled at him before. Philpo, said a calm, slender, jaded-looking man who had not even stirred from his armchair. You don't obey orders. I told you to get them out, and you've gone and brought them in. Can't you see the difference? They've thrown our things out the window, General. Good for them. Our uniforms, too. That was clever. We'll never be able to convince anyone we're superior without our uniforms. Let's get their names. Lou and... Oh, Ned, relax, said the slender man with practiced wariness. You may be pretty good at moving armored divisions into action, but you're almost useless in a social situation. Sooner or later, we'll get our uniforms back, and then we'll be their superiors again. Did they really throw our uniforms out? That was a splendid tactic. They threw everything out. The ones in the closet, too. They threw the closet out, General. That was that crash we heard when we thought they were coming in to kill us. And they'll throw you out next, Dunbar threatened. The General paled slightly. What the devil is he so mad about? He asked the Assyrian. He means it, too, the Assyrian said. You'd better let the girl leave. Lord, take her, exclaimed the general with relief. All she's done is make us feel insecure. At least she might have disliked or resented us for the $100 we paid her, but she wouldn't even do that. Your handsome young friend there seems quite attached to her. Notice the way he lets his fingers linger on the inside of her thighs as he pretends to roll up her stockings.
Mm. Yeah, it's not good that this guy's so observant.
And also fairly calm, given the circumstance.
Yeah, that's not good.
Nately, caught in the act, plushed guiltily and moved more quickly through the steps of dressing her. She was sound asleep and breathed so regularly that she seemed to be snoring softly. Let's charge her now, Lou, urged another officer. We've got more personnel and we can encircle... Oh no, Bill, answered the general with a sigh. You may be a wizard at directing a pincer movement in good weather on level terrain against an enemy that has already committed his reserves, but you don't always think so clearly anywhere else. Why should we want to keep her? General, we're in a very bad strategic position. We haven't got a stitch of clothing, and it's going to be very degrading and embarrassing for the person who has to go downstairs through the lobby to get some. Yes, Philpo, you're quite right, said the general, and that's exactly why you're the one to do it. Get going. Naked, sir. Take your pillow with you if you want to. Get some cigarettes, too, while you're downstairs picking up my underwear and pants, will you? I'll send everything up for you, Yessarian offered. There, general, said Philpo with relief. Now I won't have to go. Philpo, you nitwit, can't you see he's lying? Are you lying? Yessarian nodded, and Philpo's faith was shattered. Yessarian laughed and helped Nately walk his girl out into the corridor and into the elevator. Her face was smiling as though with a lovely dream as she slept with her head still resting on Nately's shoulder. Dobbs and Dunbar ran out into the street to stop a cab. Nately's looked up when they left the car. She swallowed dryly several times during the arduous trek up the stairs to her apartment, but she was sleeping soundly again by the time Nately undressed her and put her to bed. She slept for 18 hours, while Nately dashed about the apartment all the next morning, shushing everybody in sight, and when she woke up, she was deeply in love with him. In the last analysis, that was all it took to win her heart, a good night's sleep. The girl smiled with contentment when she opened her eyes and saw him, and then, stretching her long legs languorously beneath the rustling sheets, beckoned him into bed beside her with that look of simpering idiocy of a woman in heat. Nately moved to her in a happy daze, so overcome with rapture that he hardly minded when her kid sister interrupted him again by flying into the room and flinging herself down onto the bed between them. Nately's slapped and cursed her, but this time with laughter and generous affection, and neatly settled back smugly with an arm about each, feeling strong and protective. They made a wonderful family group, he decided. The little girl would go to college when she was old enough, to Smith or Radcliffe or Bryn Mawr. He would see to that. Nately bounded out of bed after a few minutes to announce his good fortune to his friends at the top of his voice. He called them jubilantly to come to the room and slam the door in their startled faces as soon as they arrived. He had remembered just in time that his girl had no clothes on. "Get dressed," he ordered her, congratulating himself on his alertness. "Perchet?" she asked curiously. "Perchet?" he repeated with an indulgent chuckle. "Because I don't want them to see you without any clothes on." "Perchet no?" she inquired. "Perchet no?" he looked at her with astonishment. "Because it isn't right for other men to see you naked, that's why." "Perchet no?" "Because I say no," Nately exploded in frustration. "Now don't argue with me. I'm the man and you have to do whatever I say."
That's going to go well.
"From now on, I forbid you ever to go out of this room unless you have all your clothes on. Is that clear?" Nately's looked at him as though he were insane. "Are you crazy?" "I mean every word I say. To see a pazza," she shouted at him with incredulous indignation, and sprang out of bed. Snarling unintelligibly, she snapped on panties and strode toward the door. Nately drew himself up with full manly authority. "I forbid you to leave this room that way," he informed her. "To see a pazzo," she shot back at him after he had left, shaking her head in disbelief. "Idiota! To see un pazzo imbecile!" "To see a pazzo," said her then kid sister, starting out after her in the same haughty walk. "You come back here," Nately ordered her. "I forbid you to go out that way too." "Idiota!" the kid sister called back at him with dignity after she had flounced past. "To see un pazzo imbecile!" Nately fumed in circles of distracted helplessness for several seconds and then sprinted out into the sitting room to forbid his friends to look at his girlfriend while she complained about him in only her panties. "Why not?" asked Dunbar. "Why not?" exclaimed Nately. "Because she's my girl now, and it isn't right for you to see her unless she's fully dressed." "Why not?" asked Dunbar. "You see," said his girl with a shrug. "Lui è pazzo. Sì, è molto pazzo," echoed her kid sister. "Then make her keep her clothes on if you don't want us to see her," argued Hungry Joe. "What the hell do you want from us?" "She won't listen to me," Nately confessed sheepishly. "So from now on, you all have to shut your eyes or look in the other direction when she comes in that way, okay?" "Madonna!" cried his girl in exasperation, and stamped out of the room. "Madonna!" cried her kid sister, and stamped out behind her. "Lui è pazzo," Yessarian observed good-naturedly. "I certainly have to admit it." "Hey, you crazy or something?" Hungry Joe demanded of Nately. "The next thing you know, you'll be trying to make her give up hustling." "From now on," Nately said to his girl, "I forbid you to go out hustling." "Perche?" she inquired curiously. "Perche?" he screamed with amazement. "Because it's not nice, that's why." "Perche no?" "Because it just isn't," Nately insisted. "It just isn't right for a nice girl like you to go looking for other men to sleep with. I'll give you all the money you need so you won't have to do it anymore." "And what will I do all day instead?" "Do," said Nately. "You'll do what all your friends do." "My friends go looking for men to sleep with." "Then get new friends. I don't even want you to associate with girls like that anyway. Prostitution is bad. Everybody knows that. Even him." He turned with confidence to the experienced old man. "Am I right?" "You're wrong," answered the old man. "Prostitution gives her an opportunity to meet people. It provides fresh air and wholesome exercise, and it keeps her out of trouble." "From now on," Nately declared sternly to his girlfriend, "I forbid you to have anything to do with that wicked old man." "Fafungal," his girl replied, rolling her harassed eyes up toward the ceiling. "What does he want from me?" she implored, shaking her fists. "Lasciami," she told him in menacing entreaty. "Stupido, if you think my friends are so bad, go tell your friends not to ficky-fick all the time with my friends." "From now on," Nately told his friends, "I think you fellows ought to stop running around with her friends and settle down." "Madonna!" cried his friends, rolling their harassed eyes up toward the ceiling. Nately had gone clear out of his mind. He wanted them all to fall in love right away and get married. Dunbar could marry Orr's and Yessarian could fall in love with Nurse Duckett or anyone else he liked. After the war, they could all work for Nately's father and bring up their children in the same suburb. Nately saw it all very clearly. Love had transmogrified him into a romantic idiot. And they drove him away back into the bedroom to wrangle with his girl over Captain Black. She agreed not to go to bed with Captain Black again or give him any more of Knightley's money, but she would not budge an inch on her friendship with the ugly, ill-kempt, dissipated, filthy-minded old man who witnessed Knightley's flowering love affair with insulting derision and would not admit that Congress was the greatest deliberative body in the whole world. From now on, Knightley ordered his girl firmly, "I absolutely forbid you to even speak to that disgusting old man." "Again the old man," cried the girl in wailing confusion. "Perche no, he doesn't like the House of Representatives. Mamma mia, what's the matter with you?" "Ipazzo," observed her kid sister philosophically. "That's what's the matter with him." "See," the older girl cried readily, tearing at her long brown hair with both hands. "Lui ipazzo." But she missed Knightley when he was away and was furious with the Assyrian when he punched Knightley in the face with all his might and knocked him into the hospital with a broken nose.
Okay. Huh. That's confusing.
So that was kind of a more lighthearted chapter.
Yeah.
Knightley definitely has turned into a bit of an idiot.
Well, yes. But also, I'm a little concerned about... Yeah, they've just ticked off people who are high up the food chain.
Mm.
And the thing that worries me is, what's it called? One of them deals with the Tan clans, that's one thing. The fact that one of them is the skinny, calm guy, and he's a general, I'm wondering if that's Peckham.
I don't think Peckham would be that calm under that kind of situation.
I don't know. He's strategic.
Hmm. He also doesn't know who Ysarian is, so yeah, could be. I mean, possible.
Or is another general.
They were talking about pincer movements and tanks, so it sounds like these were officers from more like the ground troop sort of tank.
Yeah. That makes more sense.
The air company.
That makes sense. Yeah.
He said to that one guy, what was his name? Falsey or Falchi or Palsy or something. Said, you know, sure, you're great when you have basically level ground and the enemy's right in your sights and they have their reinforcement.
Yeah. But you don't understand that these guys actually have all the power right now.
But yeah. Even that backhanded comment, it's like, you're good when we have the easiest situation ever to gain victory from. But aside from that...
Yeah. So, yeah. Just something about this whole situation, like, I don't think that's going to end well.
It's going to blow back on them?
Oh, for sure. Like, there's no way it won't. Dunbar's lost it. Like, to threaten them for, like, calling them currently, like, German spies and I'll shoot you.
Yeah, Dunbar really is off the deep end. I mean, he always kind of was like that. But yeah, he probably would have more tact to... Mind you, it is like a he said kind of thing because they were all naked without their uniforms. And
yeah, but there's something about him that seems very, very off. Dobbs can't shoot the colonel he wants to shoot, so he's smashing everything and everyone with the ashtray, which isn't good.
Yeah, ash stand. Do you think that's like a little like side table that's built just to be an ashtray?
I'm guessing. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I see like an iron, yeah. You know, thing with like a lampstand kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking in my head as well. And then there's the whole situation.
And there was that thing where, you know, they were obviously they were trying to get a lot of pleasure out of messing with Knightley's partner, but she didn't understand the game. Plus, she had been up for 22 hours, so.
Yeah, she just wanted to sleep. And the fact that the reason I'm nervous about that general is because he saw through, he was very observant, and he saw through when Ysarian was lying.
Mm.
Most people can't see that with Ysarian.
Right. Well, most people don't take him seriously.
Yeah. Most people don't take him seriously. Maybe the general was
switched on right enough to go, I'm going to believe what he says.
No, well, he didn't. He didn't believe what he said. Because when Ysarian said,
sorry, listens to him. Like.
Yeah. Was actually paying attention. Like something was that they were, yeah. Arfi not being part of the activity is not surprising.
Probably good considering how that played out with Knightley trying to force the other members of the company to to act rather foolish. And well, I love how even Yusarian at the end was like swearing at him in Italian and looking up at the ceiling.
Okay. Yeah, they're all imitating him. They're going, it's funny.
And of course, the little kid sister is emulating everything her sister is doing.
Yeah, it's just bad.
And Nately's really got it bad. He's like, we're a family unit now. You're going to go to college someday, a nice American college. We're all going to live in the same suburbs and raise our children. And everyone in my company is going to work for my dad.
Yeah, he's also lost. I think everyone's not quite functioning.
Mm. A fair assessment.
Yeah. It's all messed up, I think.
Hey, but at least she agreed not to sleep with Captain Black or give him any of Nately's money anymore.
That's an upside. I wonder if Captain Black's actually pimping.
Hmm.
Which wouldn't surprise me.
What about the old man? He's like, prostitution's great. It gives them exercise and they get to meet people.
Yeah, I don't know who the old man is in relation to them.
And I just love that throwaway line where he didn't believe that Congress was the best deliberative body in the world. He doesn't believe in the House of Representatives.
Well, look, the guy likes to tease him, so yes, yes, yes.
But Nately, I mean, the last conversation we were privy to with the old man, Nately is very idealistic.
Yes. He believes in things working out.
He believes in America.
Yeah, although not quite Appleby and what's his name?
Mm.
I don't know if Havermeyer does. I think Havermeyer just, yeah, you know.
I think Havermeyer's a psychopath.
There's that. Not quite Appleby styles, but pretty close. Appleby is just the nice boy next door who wouldn't think twice about killing people if it was for the good of America kind of thing.
I think Nately's a little more like Clevenger.
Yeah.
But he hasn't had his resolve tested yet. Clevenger kind of broke under.
But also Clevenger, I think Clevenger wasn't as like wealthy and well off.
No.
Yeah. Whereas Nately's a little bit unrealistic. He's blinded by his privilege doesn't allow him to see the realities that other people experience because he's not familiar with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so tricky. Like, I mean, the way that he's like, he speaks idealistic things like, oh, I don't want you to do this anymore because now you're my girl or this. I don't like, no, why not? Because it's not right. Why isn't it right? Like, he doesn't know how to respond.
Mm.
He doesn't know how to.
And as soon as
someone says, oh, next you're going to be telling us da da da, it's like, well, yes, and does it, like says it. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely, I think he even said out loud, you know, you're my girl now, so you have to do what I say, that idealistic idea of how the relationship is supposed to work at that point in time.
Yeah, and also very like, the man is in charge, the woman does what the man says.
Yeah.
And I think he's also had that modeled by his dad.
Mm.
So that's a mess. Now, I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah, well, why
Yusarian punched him in the nose?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Colonel Moodus deserved getting punched in the nose by Chief White Halfo.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
But Nately, well, if Nately keeps up like he was at the end of this chapter, maybe that does deserve a punching.
Yeah, maybe. Or at least his ass kicked. Yes, yes, definitely. So it's been an interesting chapter. Notice that we didn't... I think there's no mention of Danica, so I have no idea what's happening there. But
I also want to point out that, to the best of my knowledge now, like the last, I'd say, four chapters at least, have all been sequential at the end of the timeline. We haven't done any jumping. I mean, there's been a short thing where I think we went back to Yusarian and Snowden.
Yeah.
But for the most part, this has been
it does seem to be in order. It seems to be now actually ramping. So we'll find out the next step and the next step and the next step. Although I don't know where the Milo attack is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know where that fits in terms of the timeline yet.
Because, here's the funny thing. And I could be misremembering this, but it seemed like when Milo bombed the headquarters, Danica was still like a doctor, because he was out there administering, you know, he was helping.
Mm.
Now he could just be doing that because that's who he is now, but.
Yeah, it's curious to see what happens.
You think if it had already happened, we'd have heard more about it.
Yeah, but I also wonder if, because both Dunbar and Ysarion are basically at the stage where Hungry Joe is at.
Mm.
I mean, we just the description of that previous chapter of Ysarion's frenetic search for physical relief.
Mm.
That's what Hungry Joe is doing.
Yeah, it's just Hungry Joe just wanted to photograph people, but Ysarion actually wants to sleep with.
Yes, but either way, it's just that panicking.
And he needs something very specific, because all the times he slept with someone, it wasn't giving him what he needed.
No, and that's why, even though the green, the lime green underwear maid, you know, is showing interest in an opportunity, it's not of interest in, because he's looking for Luciana or Duckett.
Mm. Or that lady who Arfi threw her ring at the window, even though he hardly knows her.
I think that was Luciana.
It was it sounded like a separate person in that chapter.
No, it was, from memory, it was Luciana. I'm trying to find out. Scrolling. Oh my god, so many pages. No, he went searching hungrily through the streets for Luciana, whose laugh and invisible scar he had never forgotten, or the boozy, blowsy, bleary-eyed, floozy. You're right. He was looking at me. Yeah, sorry, I got confused between the people.
Oh, good.
But all blurred into one thing, which, I mean, is the point. He was looking for those specific.
Well, the reason I brought her up is just sounds weird, because he has a real connection with Nurse Duckett. Luciana, he shared a connection with. That lady who Arfi threw the ring at, I think they may have exchanged a few words.
He fed her, I think. Was it Luciana?
Although we do know that Ysarion seems to fall in love with women for a myriad of reasons.
For various reasons, yeah. No, but I think with the girl, was she he got frustrated because of the Arfi factor there.
Mm.
The fact that Arfi just was controlling and weird about the situation.
That'd do it.
Yeah, so that probably has left him connected with her.
Imagine having to think of Arfi when you're making love.
Yeah, I don't think. Anyway. But yes, so we've got the next chapter has an interesting title.
Thanksgiving.
Yes. Well, because they are heading towards winter now.
Mm. Yeah, so. There was those rainstorms. They could only like fly the one day a week that it was clear, and then it would just be bucketing down. And it was getting so cold that, like, you know, no one wanted to deal with Kid Samson's legs. And
yeah, that whole situation. Well, I think there was more to why they didn't want to deal with Kid Samson's legs.
Yeah, but the weather certainly did not help matters.
No. No, it did not.
Well, you know, even with as bad as the weather has been here, to bring it full circle to the start of the podcast, we don't have any stumps to deal with.
Yeah, no. Well, at least not in our personal experiences. No.
I mean, every now and then I see a pigeon on the street with missing a foot, but.
No. Let us not compare fictional human being death to. I'm still not over that scene.
It was pretty graphic.
It was very gruesome, yeah. War stories.
Funniest thing is, yeah, I think that's the most graphic depiction of death in the story. And it was, I mean, it wasn't fire, but it's technically friendly fire.
It's the outcome of when war is treated with no regard for human life, and the mental cost and the emotional cost. And all like just this, where you lose your ability to make decisions that think about risk properly. Mm. Your sense of being able to gauge risk is thrown out completely. Mm. And foolishness, like McQuat should have been reported the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But then the system and the processes wouldn't have done anything because they just need a pilot.
Yep.
And also your Sarian stuff tends to get dismissed.
Yes, because no one listens to him.
No, and he's generally not wrong anyway, but also he sometimes doesn't report when he should be, but yeah.
He's just a bit of a dick sometimes.
Yeah, it's frustrating. But yes, now, I think we shall wrap it up for this week, and then next week continue with Thanksgiving.
I mean, we're about a month off, but we're in the same season as Thanksgiving at the moment. Well, yeah, we aren't because we're on the other side of the planet. But, you know, if we were living where this book was written or where this book is taking place, it would be closing out on Thanksgiving.
Well, on harvest season, but yes. Because the place where this book is written, Thanksgiving, is not a relevant topic. they don't.
Oh, no, but I mean this time of year.
Yes, but even...
It will be fall.
No, the time of year is the same. It's the season is different.
Well, that's what I mean. It's
yes, I know what you mean.
It is a similar time of year right now because it is October when we are recording.
Yes, it is October.
And it will be autumn in Italy.
Yes, and it is
That's what I meant.
Yes.
Because Thanksgiving, in my mind, coming from America, it's to me it was more associated with fall than it was like November or what it's actually celebrating. It really felt like a harvest festival.
Well, it is. It's associated with the harvest festivals of the past. Mm-hmm. I think in one big situations. But yes, and now we're heading towards our summer whilst transitioning through spring and suffering. Pain. So much pain. But yes, so on that note,
Well, thank you for listening this week. We hope you enjoyed yourself. The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch 22. And the music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
You can find me at Rue McMoo, that's RooMcMoo, and you can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast, that's on Twitter, on Facebook, and if you add @gmail.com, that's our email address.
Yep, please, we'd love to hear your feedback, how you're enjoying the podcast, how you're enjoying the book, what you're reading yourself. Do you have any suggestions of books you think it would be amusing for us to read and discuss on the podcast in the future? We'd love to hear from you. And if you listen to us on iTunes or Spotify or anywhere where you can rate or review the podcast, we would appreciate it.
Yes. And that note, yes.
Yeah, enjoy your reading. Please stay safe, and we'll see you next week.